This is Ajahn Sumedho, Volume 4 in the anthology, and two or three talks in a row, depending on the time. This is talk number 6, Identity. Is there anyone, any person, or any condition that is absolutely right or absolutely wrong? Can right and wrong, or good and bad, be absolute? When you dissect it, when you really look at it in terms of the way it is now, there is nothing to it. It's foam on the sea. It's soap bubbles. Yet this is how we can get ourselves completely caught up in illusions. We'll sacrifice our life for an illusion in order to protect our identities, our positions, our territories. We're very territorial. We think that this England here belongs to the English. When we take that apart, does this plot of land here say it's England? When I do walking meditation outside, does the earth come up and say, "You're walking on me, England"? It's never said that. Yet I say I'm walking here in England. I'm the one who's calling it England, and that is an identity, a conventional identity. We all agree to call this plot of land here England, but it's not really that. It is what it is. Yet we'll fight, torture people, and commit the most atrocious acts over territory, quibbling about just 1 inch of property on a border. The land doesn't belong to anybody. Even if I own land legally, this belongs to Ajahn Sumedho. It doesn't really. That's just a convention. When we bind ourselves to these conventions and these illusions, then of course we're troubled, because illusions are unstable and not in line with Dhamma. We end up wasting our lives trying to increase this sense of identification, this sense of, it's mine, it belongs to me, and I want to protect it and hand it down to future generations. We create a whole realm of illusion, personality, and identity through the perceptions that we create in our minds, which arise and cease and have no real core, no essence. We can be very threatened when these illusions are challenged. I remember first questioning the reality of my personality. It scared me to death. When I started questioning, even though I wasn't particularly overconfident and didn't have great self-esteem, I have never been prone to megalomania. Usually the opposite, very self-critical. I felt very threatened when that security, that confidence in being this screwed-up personality, was being threatened. There is a sense of stability, even among people who identify themselves with illnesses or other negative things like alcoholism. Being identified with some sort of mental disease like paranoia, schizophrenia, or whatever, gives us a sense that we know who we are and we can justify the way that we are. We can say, "I can't help the way I am. I'm a schizophrenic." That gives us a sense of allowing us to be a certain way. It may be a sense of confidence or stability in the fact that our identities are labeled and we all agree to look at one another in this way, with this label, with this perception. So you realize the courage it takes to question, to allow the illusory world that we have created to fall apart, as with a nervous breakdown when the world falls apart. When the security that is offered and the safety and confidence that we gain from that illusion starts cracking and falling apart, it's very frightening. Yet within us, there's something that guides us through it. What brings us into this monastic life? It's some intuitive sense, a sense behind the sense, an intelligence behind all the knowledge and the cleverness of our minds. Yet we can't claim it on a personal level. We always have to let go of the personal perceptions, because as soon as we claim them, we're creating another illusion. Instead of claiming, identifying, or attaching, we begin to realize or recognize the way it is. This is the practice of awareness and paying attention, sati sampajanya. In other words, it's going to the center point, to the buddho, the one who knows, position. This buddha rupa, here in the temple, it's the still point. It's a symbol, an image representing the human form at the still point. Then there is this encouragement to what we call meditation. This word meditation can mean all kinds of things. It's a word that includes any kind of mental practices, good or bad. But when I use this word, what I'm mainly using it for is that sense of centering, establishing, resting in the center. The only way that one can really do that is not to try and think about it and analyze it. You have to trust in just a simple act of attention, of awareness. It's so simple and so direct that our complicated minds get very confused. What's he talking about? I've never seen any still point. I've never found a still point in me. When I sit and meditate, there's nothing still about it. But there's an awareness of that. Even if you think you've never had a still point or you're a confused, messed up character that really can't meditate, trust in the awareness of that very perception. That's why I encourage whatever you think you are to think it deliberately. Really explore the kind of perceptions you have of yourself so that they're not just habitually going through your mind and you're either believing in them or trying to get rid of them. The more we try to get rid of personalities, the more confused we get. If you assume that you have to get rid of your personality in some way because it's an illusion, then you're caught in another illusion. I'm someone that has a personality that I've got to get rid of. I'm the personality that's got to get rid of my personality. This doesn't go anywhere, and it's ridiculous. Personality is not something to get rid of, but to know. Be a personality. Then, really intentionally be one. Take it to absurdity. That's a lot of fun. Take your personality to where it's totally absurd and listen to it. Your relationship is not one of identity, but of recognizing that you are creating this personality, this changing condition. I can't create any kind of personal perception that lingers, that stays. There's nothing that I can create through my mental powers that has any staying power on a personal level. It's all very illusory, very changing, very ephemeral. However, there is that which can be aware of the personality as a construction. I deliberately think, I am a screwed up person that needs to meditate in order to become enlightened in the future. I think that, but I'm listening to it. I'm deliberately thinking it, and I'm investigating it. I have created that perception. I have chosen to think that, and I can hear myself thinking it. That which is aware and listens to that perception, I don't create. It's not a creation, is it? I create this perception, but not that which is aware of the perception. You can investigate, begin to know the difference between awareness and thinking. What is the still point, the center, the point that includes? This kind of thinking is reflective, isn't it? I'm just asking myself this question to bring attention to it. I'm not looking for somebody to give me an answer. But it's a reflective question that clarifies my attention. It helps me to focus, to be aware. The more I pay attention and am aware, the more I recognize that in this still point, there's this resounding sound of silence. I didn't create that. I can't claim that the sound of silence is some personal creation of mine, that it belongs to Ajahn Sumedho. It's like trying to claim the air, to claim space. All the space in the world belongs to me. That kind of ridiculous thing. You can't create a person around it. You can only be. This sense of being the still point, of resting, opening to, and allowing the personality, the body, and the emotional habits and thoughts that arise. Our relationship to them now is understanding or embracing rather than identifying. As soon as we identify, we have a negative thought and it hooks us. I feel some negative feeling. Oh, here I go again, being critical and negative about somebody. I shouldn't do that. I've been a monk all these years, and how can I stop doing that? I've lost it. I've identified with a negative thought, and it triggers all kinds of feelings of despair. I shouldn't be like this. I shouldn't think like this. A good monk should love everybody. Then, with awareness, I suddenly stop, and I'm back in the center again. So just to recognize, no matter how many times you go out on the wheel, it's just a very simple act of attention to come back to center. It's not that difficult or remote. We're just not used to it. We're used to being on the turning wheel. We're used to going around and around and becoming all kinds of things. We're used to that. We're used to delusions, fantasies, dreams. We're used to extremes. And what we're used to, we incline to, if we're not attentive, not vigilant. When we aren't aware, vigilant, and attentive, we fall back into the realm of suffering. But when we cultivate awareness, we deprogram those habits. We don't feed these illusions anymore. We're not believing, not following, not resisting. We're not making a problem, about the body as it is, or about the memories, thoughts, habits, or personality that we have. We're not judging or condemning, praising, adulating, or exaggerating anything. It is what it is. As we do that, our identity with it begins to slip away. We no longer seek identity with our illusions. We've broken through that. When we've seen through that illusion of self, of what we think we are, then our inclination is towards this center point, this Buddho position. This is something you can really trust. That's why I keep saying this, just as a way of encouraging you. If you think about it, you don't trust it. You can get very confused because other people will say other things, and you'll hear all kinds of views and opinions about meditation, Buddhism, and all that. Within this Sangha, there are so many monks and nuns, so many views and opinions. So it's a matter of learning to trust yourself, the ability to be aware rather than think, I'm not good enough to trust myself. I've got to develop the jhanas first. I've got to purify my sila first. I've got to get rid of my neurotic problems and my traumas before I can really meditate. If you believe that, then that is what you'll have to do. But if you begin to see what you're doing, if you see that very illusion, then you can trust in that simple recognition. It's not condemning the illusion. It's not saying you shouldn't do those things. I'm not saying you shouldn't purify your sila or resolve your emotional problems, shouldn't go to therapy, or shouldn't develop the jhanas. I'm not making any statement about should or shouldn't, but rather I'm pointing to something that you can trust, this awareness, sati sampajanya, here and now. Suppose you come to me and say, Ajahn Sumedho, I'm really screwed up. I was very badly treated when I was a child. I've got so many neurotic problems and fears. I really need to go to therapy and to get these things straightened up somehow because I can't really meditate the way I am. If I replied, well, yeah, you should. You're really screwed up. I think you should go to a therapist and straighten yourself out first, then meditate after that. Would that be very helpful? Would I be pointing to the still point or perpetuating your own self-view? That view might even be right on a worldly level, and I'm not saying you shouldn't go to therapy. This is best, not to tell you that you are this way or that way, not to give you some kind of identity to attach to, but to empower or encourage you to trust in your own ability to wake up, to pay attention. What will result from that, I don't know. I hope it will be good. But what's true is that your true identity isn't dependent upon any condition. Pointing to the present, the Pajupana Dhamma, we can grasp that idea, so then we think we don't need to do all those things. We don't need to be monks or nuns. We don't need therapy. We can just meditate. Pure meditation will solve all our problems. Then we grasp that and become anti-religious. All religion is a waste of time. Psychotherapy is a waste of time. You don't need that. All you need to do is be mindful and meditate. That's another viewpoint, isn't it? Those kinds of opinions are not pointing to the center. They're judging the conditions or conventions. You don't need religion. It's all a bunch of rubbish. And even though you can say it is true that ultimately all that you need to do is wake up, as simple as that, that is in itself a convention of language. This empowerment or encouragement points to an imminent act of awakening, not to tell you that you are some kind of person, that you're asleep and should wake up, or that you should grasp that idea, but to the sense of actually being that. In the Western world, we get very complicated because usually we don't have a lot of sadha, or faith. The Asian Buddhists tend to be more culturally attuned to this. They have a lot of faith in Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, a teacher, or something. Most of us come to Buddhism or become a samana when we're adults, and we're skeptical. Usually we've gone through a lot of skeptical doubts and strong self-images, a hard, strong sense of individuality. My personality was a doubting, skeptical one. Doubt, vichikicca, was one of my greatest obstructions. That's why I couldn't be a Christian, because I couldn't believe what I was supposed to believe in. It was just totally impossible for me to believe in the kind of doctrines that you have to believe in to be a Christian. Not only was I a skeptical, doubting character, I was also, at the age of 32, quite cynical. I had been through a lot and had quite a lot of bitterness about life. I was not pleased with my life at 32. I was disappointed with myself and a lot of others. There was despair, bitterness, and doubt, and just a faint light at the end of the tunnel was in Buddhism. That was the one thing I still had some hope for. That was a sign that drew me into this life. The good thing about being highly individualistic, skeptical, and doubtful is that you do tend to question everything. That which is sacred and never questioned in most religions is open to question. One thing I appreciated with Lungpo Cha was that everything was up for questioning. He was never one for a peremptory approach of, you have to believe in this and you have to believe in that. There was never that hard, heavy-handed, dictatorial style. It was much more this reflective questioning and inquiry. One of the problems with Westerners is that we're complicated because of our lack of faith. Our identities get so complicated in so many ways, and we take everything personally. Sexual desire and the sexual forces in the body are regarded as very personal. The same is true with hunger and thirst. We identify with them in a very personal way. We take on other basic natural forces and judge ourselves. We shouldn't be cowardly and weak, pusillanimous. Whatever.
Fearful.
We get complicated because we judge ourselves endlessly, criticize ourselves according to high, noble standards that we can never live up to. We get very self-disparaging, neurotic, and depressed because we're not in touch with nature. We've come from the world of ideas rather than from realizing the natural law. So in meditation, it is a matter of recognizing the way it is, the Dhamma, or the natural law, the way things are. The sexual desire is like this. It's not mine. The body is like this. It's a sexual body, so it's going to have these energies. It has sexual organs. It's made like this. This is the way it is, so it's not personal. I didn't create it. We begin to look at the most obvious things, the basics, the human body, in terms of the way it is, rather than identifying with it personally. Hunger and thirst are like this. We investigate the instinctual energies, the urge for survival. We have strong survival and procreative instincts, hunger and thirst, the urge to protect ourselves, the need for safety. We all need to feel some kind of physical safety, which is a survival instinct. These are basic to the animal kingdom, not just the human. So now it is time that it needn't be seen in this way. No matter how complicated it is, the practice is very simple. This is where we need a lot of patience, because when we're very complicated, we may lack patience with ourselves. We've got clever minds, we think very quickly, and we have strong passions, so it's easy to get lost. It's very confusing for us because we don't know how to transcend or to see it all in perspective. So in pointing to this center point, to this still point, to the here and now, I'm pointing to the way of transcendence or escape. Not escape by running away out of fear, but the escape hatch that allows us to get perspective on the mess, on the confusion, on the complicated self that we have created and identify with. It's very simple and uncomplicated, but if you start thinking about it, you can make it very complicated. Oh, I don't know if I can do that. But that's where this trust comes in. If you're aware that, oh, I don't know, is a perception in the present, that I don't think I'll ever realize Nibbana is a perception in the present, trust in that awareness. That's all you need to know. It is what it is. We're not even judging that perception. We're not saying, what a stupid perception. We're not adding anything. And that awareness of it, that's what I'm pointing to, the awareness. Learn to trust in that awareness rather than in what the perception is saying. The perception might even be common sense in a way, but the attachment to it is where you get lost. We should practice meditation. We should not be selfish, and we should learn to be more disciplined and more responsible for our lives. That's very good advice, But if I attach to that, what happens? I go back to thinking, I'm not responsible enough. I've got to become more responsible, and I shouldn't be selfish. I'm too selfish, and I shouldn't be. And I'm back on the turning wheel again. One gets intimidated, even by the best advice. What to do? Trust in the awareness of it. I should be responsible. It is seen, and one's relationship to it is no longer that of grasping. Maybe if that resonates as something to do, then I'll be more responsible. It's not a matter of denying, blotting out, condemning, or believing, but of trusting in the attitude of attention and awareness, rather than endlessly trying to sort it out on the turning wheel with all its complicated thoughts and habits, where you just get dizzy and totally confused. The still point gives you perspective on the conditions, on the turning wheel, on the confusion, on the mess. It puts you into a relationship to it, that is knowing it for what it is, rather than some kind of personal identity with it. You can see that your true nature is this knowing, this pure state, pure consciousness, pure awareness. You are learning to remember that, to be that, your real home, what you really are rather than what you think you are according to the conditioning of your mind. We'll just stop there. It's 10:22. So that was just the first one. Identity.
Questions, comments?
I feel like for me, like just maybe because it's early into the practice and kind of watching my mind, that it's kind of helpful to respond to my thoughts in ways that I think is helpful.
Yes.
Maybe it's not.
Well, it depends on the response.
If it's a kind response.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of trying to direct it to a more, like, wholesome...
Well, part of it is you have to pay attention to the results. Yeah, but I think what Mpo Samedo is particularly trying to get across is the tendency that we have to create our identity around our thoughts. And then the sense of, say, like, lack. I'm lack in, especially if we're meditating or practicing, I lack enlightenment. I need to be enlightened. I lack meditative stillness. I have to get my meditation together. I lack virtue. I really got to toughen myself up. And the thing is all of those things are things that the Buddha is encouraging to do, but we tend to fix our sense of self around that, and then we suffer because of it. So it's like understanding understanding the process of dukkha. How do we create dukkha, and how do we step off that cycle of creating dukkha? And it's that simple act of knowing that is so critical, so key, and so important. And we oftentimes overlook that or look past it, because we try to be something, we try to get something, we try to get the right thoughts that will conform with a good Buddhist or a good meditator. So it's just understanding that process. And it is important to respond to thoughts in the sense that, we can say, oh, I shouldn't get involved. I should just, because sometimes we just say, well, I should know it. But then oftentimes what that is you just think what you just sort of get whatever the mind throws out, then you end up just following. So you have to pay attention to the results. What is it that's helpful? What helps the mind become more clear, more steady, more increased well-being, decreased dukkha?
I liked his image, a couple of things. I liked his image of the wheel, yeah. Like that there's the still point in the center. That's the awareness of your thoughts and everything.
Yeah.
And that's always accessible no matter what, as a refuge. And then the other point being that all the wholesome things like sila, samadhi, the wholesome dhammas, they're all pointing back to being able to trust in that awareness.
The quality of awareness.
For the sake of that awareness.
That's their main purpose and function. It's like I can't remember the sutta. It's in the early part, the beginning kind of section of the Majjhima Nikaya, where the Buddha is saying that we don't. And I can't remember, it's not fresh in my mind, but we don't practice for the sake of perfection of sila or perfection of samadhi or perfection of wisdom, but we practice for the sure heart's release is what we practice for. And it's not a negation. Therefore you don't need to keep precepts or meditate or reflect skillfully. It's not that. You use all those things, but you understand their purpose, their function.